Hey, welcome back, everybody, to my podcast. It's been gone for a minute. Busy summer. Now we're back, and the first guest back on for the new season is my good friend, Danny Mills. He's the GM of the Perth Wildcats in Australia. And today he gives us some deep insights on his job, on the transition from being an NBA scout at Philadelphia to the GM position that he currently holds. He talked about the process in Philadelphia, as well as his process now in Perth and how it's going and how what things he pays attention to the most. The relationship with the coach and a lot of different things, balance in personal life, family and job, and things that are more important behind the scenes that nobody thinks about. So this episode was very interesting in regards to managing a team for future GMs, for scouts, for aspiring executives. Please tune in every time a podcast comes out. Press the subscribe button. You get notified when a new episode comes out. We're back on it. We're back on fire. And hopefully you're going to tune in and stay put. All right. Talk to you soon. And thanks for being here. Bye. All right, Danny, welcome to my little podcast world here.
Hey, Bennis. Thanks, man. Appreciate it. I've been an avid listener since you started this, and I'm excited to be on and honored. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. You're going to have to guide me through it a little bit. I'm a little bit rusty because I had a little break in the summer for obvious reasons, and now trying to ramp it back up, and you're the first guest on. So we're going to swim together today.
Love it, man. Well, it's awesome. Your break included coming to Australia to see us. So that was exciting to have you down in the Gold Coast.
Yeah, let's make it a yearly habit to meet each other in the Gold Coast for the Blitz. I mean, that was an amazing experience. Afterwards, I did go to Singapore. That was kind of, I'm afraid to say, Singapore as a city was nicer or more for me, because it was the first time. Maybe that's also the case, because Singapore is, there's something special to it, that place.
Definitely a fascinating city in Southeast Asia. It's a very cool place. I'm jealous you got to go up there.
you've been in a nice couple cities as well. One of them, Berlin. That's where our ties are from. I think that's where we interacted the most when we lived there. I lived there a little bit less than you. You were there more often with the family. What do you remember from Berlin?
Yeah, amazing memories. We were there from 2014 to 2016. Amazing city. We loved it. Our first son Nicholas was born there. That's obviously special to Megan and I, but just in general, Germany we loved, but Berlin especially, just an incredibly rich city that's vibrant, full of culture, history, awesome people, and we really enjoyed it, and honestly, could have stayed there for a lot longer.
Yeah, it's a different vibe. It's hard to explain to people. It's like I said, vibrant. A lot of people go in and out of the city, but it's so much substance in that city that's hard to explain. You have to really live it and experience it.
Definitely.
So before we dive into the podcast, you know, the podcast is about eternal growth and impacting the sports business in various ways, and I hope that we can be some influencers today for some up and coming sports directors, GMs, scouts, whatever. And your experience is very valuable to this listeners, to this crowd that's watching us on YouTube right now. All the 55 people, I think, that's gonna watch it. No, I hope it's gonna be more than that. But it's before we're gonna dive into it, I was wondering about your. Here's the curveball for you. Your Irish national team experience as a player. Talk to me about that a little bit.
Oh, man, you're bringing me back some good memories. Fortunate. So my father's from Cork in Ireland, born and raised, and then he came to Australia. So early on, I got an Irish passport when I was growing up in Australia, and that led to an opportunity when I was in college in the States. Got asked to, you know, basically try out for the senior men's national team. And at that point in time, the Irish senior team was in the B division of the European Championships, trying to qualify to get to the A's. And the team was made up of 9 Americans that had an Irish passport, an Australian, myself, and then 2 guys that were actually born in Ireland. So that's when, like, you couldn't just have the one naturalized guy. You could have unlimited as long as you had the passport.
Yeah.
So in the summer of 2005 and 2006, I was with the senior Irish national team. Amazing experience. I was still in college, but we had some really good players like Pat Burke, Dan Callahan, Cal Boulder, Jim Moran. We had some really good players. Jay Larranega.
Jay Larranega, yeah, that's right.
Jay. So some really good players, guys that are coaching in the NBA now at a high level. Jim and Jay, and then some guys that actually played. And for me, I was just the young guy that was still in college. But awesome experience. Got to travel all around Europe for 6 weeks. We were based in Dublin. And yeah, just a really, really fun time.
That's cool. Yeah, that's cool. How did you guys end?
Yeah, so it was interesting. So we toured around and played some European qualifier games. And then because we were in the B division, I think it was Slovakia, Malta, and Denmark were the teams in our group. And then we won our group, and then we crossed over. Denmark wasn't in our group, but we won our group, and then our crossover was Denmark. And if we'd won that home and home series, we would have gotten promoted to the A division.
Yeah.
We won in Dublin by about, I think it was 13 or 14 points. And then we had to go to Aarhus in Denmark and lose by less than that to win the home and home, just the point differential. And at that point in time, Pat Burke had just got signed by the Phoenix Suns. And so during that week time, he had to go back for training camp. So we missed Pat. And we went to Denmark, and we ended up losing by like 15 or 16. And so we didn't qualify for the A's. And so that kept Ireland in the B's. And they put so much resource financially into that campaign to get Ireland basketball into the A division. I don't think Ireland basketball since then has really gotten back to that level. And then obviously the rules with FIBA had changed, and we don't have the same amount of I guess you would call them Bosmans, or you know, you could have, like I said, 10 of us weren't born in Ireland. We just had passports through parents or grandparents. So
yes, it was a unique opportunity missed for Ireland. That it was just that once in a lifetime probably opportunity.
100%. But it was an amazing experience. Great, great people. Still in touch with quite a few of them today. And yeah, really enjoyed it.
So let's touch on your career a little bit. When did you decide to hang it up as a player, and what drew you to the management side of things early on in your path? What was your path into the management role?
Yeah, so I played all my junior basketball in Australia. Went to the AIS, which is the Center of Excellence now in Canberra, for a year, and then from there, like a lot of Australian kids, went to college in the States. So I went to a junior college in Missouri, Three Rivers. And then I transferred to Oregon Tech, so an NAIA school, and finished up my career in 2007 and was kind of like, was done just playing. And I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And then moved to San Diego, just in a normal job outside of basketball, but then got brought back into it in coaching. And so I was kind of just had the itch to get back into sports. And I thought coaching was definitely the path. So I was at the University of San Diego for a year as like a volunteer grad assistant. So kind of like a lot of people, just getting your foot in the door, doing whatever you can just to kind of break into the industry. And then after that, my wife Megan was in the US Navy, and she got offered 3 years to move to Italy, Sicily, Italy, with the Navy. And so after doing a year of coaching in college, I wanted to stay in coaching. And so we moved to Italy, and I was fortunate enough to find some connections and stayed in coaching out there in Sicily for 3 years with two different pro teams.
That's interesting. And that's life in Sicily abroad first time. That must have been a nice experience too. Cultural difference.
Yeah, the life experience was incredible. Sicily is an amazing, amazing place. And yeah, I was fortunate to be with two really cool teams down there. Capo d'Orlando, who a few years before I was there were in Serie A, which is amazing for a town of like 15,000 people. Yep. And then my last year, I moved to Barcelona, which is in Sicily in Italy, but we were in Liga 2 that year, which was second division in Italy, and really cool experience. Yeah.
And you, you went in what role there? In coaching, right?
Yeah, coaching. So I was an assistant coach at both clubs.
So what was the transition to a scouting role from there?
Yeah, so during those 3 years, I started traveling just in our off seasons to, like, I think it was the under 17, World Cup and under 19 World Cup, and just started doing some scouting and sending back some reports to some connections I'd made through some NBA teams, to an under 17 Australian national team coach about some junior tournaments I'd watched about opponents that were going to play at the World Cup. And just really fell in love with more of the evaluation talent ID type process, and started to figure out that actually the NBA does have a big international operation and teams do scout globally. And so started to find some connections that way, but I still moved back from Italy. I went, like a lot of people do, go to NBA Summer League. I was trying to find any way into an NBA video room or whatever, and I found myself in the G League with the Bakersfield Jam. And so after 3 years in Italy, we moved back to California. Bakersfield, was there for a year. Had an amazing staff that are now all littered throughout the NBA, and worked with some really, really cool people and good experience. I was a video coordinator that year, so started to learn the NBA G League game. And then after that season was when I was fortunate enough to have a connection through a close friend of mine that introduced me to some people in the 76ers, and they were looking for information on some players and did some projects. And one thing led to another and was hired by them as an international scout.
It's such a zigzag of a route. I mean, it's hard to predict. And that's another proof that there's no unique, or there's no one route that somebody can take to become an NBA scout or an executive. Is everybody has their own path through their own connections, through just persistence, working in your job that you currently do, and then somehow there's doors that open up, or there's a crack in a door here and there that kind of, you know, opens up a new pathway. And that's living proof right there that it's unpredictable. It's nothing you can really manufacture.
Oh, for sure. It really is. And like, I could never have imagined when I graduated from Oregon Tech as a player, the path that it took me to get to, I guess, where I am now back home, which is unique, but just all of the stops, like you said, in between, and the different levels and the different positions. So, you put your head down, you work hard, you're a good person. You make connections, you stay in touch with people, and usually good things happen.
Yeah, I agree. It's some, whenever you don't pursue it eagerly desperately, things happen to you naturally. And I think that's the best way for you to really not force it, but let it happen as you work. And there's something that I listened to some podcasts recently where talking about drive and motivation and persistence, and it's more about, some people do it out of anger or insecurities, just to try to prove people wrong. And this kind of it's a pushing thing. It pushes you, you know. But the goal is to find something that pulls you, right? It has to be something that you seek out, and it pulls you automatically, and it pulls you into the right direction, instead of something that pushes you through some insecurities, fears that you have inside of being inadequate or just trying to prove everybody wrong. There's a difference between the two, I think.
For sure. I totally agree. It's it definitely has to pull you. And you have to be resilient and just continue to have an open mind and the belief that, you know, if you continue to believe in what you're doing and you're around good people and you continue to do good work, like, things are gonna fall into place. And it's unpredictable. Like, obviously, there's a lot of, I guess, there can be insecurity because you don't know what's next. You just don't know what's around the corner. But at the most inopportune time, like, that's when opportunity really knocks, and you got to be ready. Yeah. Like, when that door opens, if you're not prepared, then that's when that opportunity can slip. But if you are prepared, when that opportunity comes, then usually those people are the ones that can walk right through it.
100% agree. That was just to give a little background, maybe for the people who don't know my path. It was that there was a little crack in a door when I went from Germany second division to Moscow. All of a sudden, it was just a small crack in the door that was, you could never predict it in 100 years that it's going to be opening up for me, right? Specifically. for a Lithuanian kid growing up in Germany, playing in second division, coaching in second division, and then all of a sudden at CSKA, there's a crack in the door. And I was doing scouting reports throughout the last years of my career as an assistant coach, just by doing it the way I knew it was supposed to be done when I got it in college from our assistant coaches. So I was just learning by doing myself, video work and everything around it. And then when the opportunity came, if I wouldn't have done all those things that kind of I felt they were necessary for our club, for our players, I would not have been ready for that opportunity, even if it still opened up. I would have been there for a couple of months and I would have been probably back in Germany. So luckily, I prepared myself for the opportunity without knowing that the opportunity will arrive. I think that's a valid point. So
yeah,
so definitely. You were there with the 76ers throughout the process, right? The rebuilding and Sam Hinkie and everything that was the whole spiel that was around the 76ers at that time. We don't have to get into the whole process thing, but what's the biggest takeaway you have from that currently helps you today that maybe you thought you drew some valuable lessons from that period?
Yeah, I was very fortunate. And Sam and Vince Rosman were the two people that hired me into Philadelphia. And as we talked about, my first role was international scout, moved back to Europe, based ourselves in Berlin. Amazing experience. Unfortunately, it was only 2 years with Sam until we had a change there in management. But such a visionary, such an amazing forward-thinking executive, incredibly smart, but also very – just had such a good human element to him. Made you feel very, secure in your own thinking. Like he would evaluate the room and take in everything and then obviously make a decision that he felt was best, but would take in every piece of information, wanted that more than anything. And so I took that. I think, having a broad range of opinions when you're making big decisions. So taking in a lot of information, but also just not skipping steps. So like good things over and sustainable success takes so much time to build, and if you skip steps you're never going to get there. And so it's hard, like we're in professional sports and you're judged on wins and losses, and we all understand that. But with that, having a longer lens and having sitting in a room and thinking about things maybe 3 or 4 years ahead, as opposed to being reactionary to problems that happen now, being more solution driven, I think is something that I probably took from those guys. And the massive amounts of data that they would use just to make decisions, whether it's Intel, obviously advanced numbers, analytics, but putting that all into one big pot, I guess, and using that as their decision-making formula, as opposed to just like looking at maybe one or two things and then being blindsided because you hadn't seen the whole picture.
Yeah, it's like a puzzle almost, right? You put it together from all the bits and pieces that you can collect from every aspect of scouting, and at the end of the day, it's still not a clear picture that you have when the puzzle is complete. You kind of, it's blurry, and you have to make a decision based on the puzzle pieces if they fit neatly together or not.
Yeah, exactly. And at the end of the day, I mean, you're one of the best at it. Like we're evaluating human beings. Like it's an inexact science, and if you bat 500 on draft picks, you're doing pretty well.
Yeah.
And so there's so much that goes into it, and it can be frustrating, but it's also, I think there's something about it that's kind of addicting, that like you want to find as much information about whether that prospect or the person that you're looking at, so you feel the most comfortable about the decision you make.
So what would you consider skipping steps then? What's a skipping step for you?
Yeah, I think being reactionary to different situations that come up, like especially probably in my position now, like making decisions on personnel, like maybe things aren't going so well and you want to change someone, or you want to look at like different lineups or whatever, but like not just thinking about it irrationally just from like one or two game sample size. Like don't skip skits. Let's get a bigger sample size of like, all right, why isn't this working?
It's not so just opposite of Europe.
Yeah. it is amazing to see some of the changes that happen quickly, right, around the world in basketball. And the NBA is completely different because they do have a lot longer lens on things. But international basketball is very competitive, as you know, with clubs and some of the quick changes of personnel or coaches is just like, wow, like you got to give it time. Like it takes months, years to have things build over time. And so
it's tough in everybody's really position, hard. Your position, the coach's position, the impulsiveness and the emotional part of the game, which we all, whoever is working here in this business, is to an extent just it's emotional. And you have to somehow find and manage your emotions in those, in the heat of the moment, and not make an impulsive decision. And plus, you know, yeah. You can compare NBA is all long guaranteed contracts by everybody. In Europe, it's less so. So you are more viable to make a quick decision and just kind of spur the moment. And sometimes it helps, but most of the time it's to the detriment. And it's hard to really project if the process and the process in parentheses, if it's working or not, judging off 1 month or say 2-3 weeks, because you have to see. Even despite some losses, the process could be correct. It could be the right way. You're on the right path. The coach is teaching the right things. And it's just a matter of breaking at some point, breaking through. And if the players believe in it, then I think you're on the right path. And I think that's something that probably in your position, you have to observe the most.
Yeah, exactly. Like, progress is not always linear. Like, there's ups and downs. But as long as you're trending in that right direction, as long as it might take, as long as you can see the upward trajectory and just you're optimistic that what you're doing day to day is adding up to sustained long-term success, then I think you really have to stick with it longer over the longer term, as opposed to being just short tempered and like reactionary to one or two games or to outside expectations and pressures. Yeah. Like you gotta really believe in what you're doing and trust it. Yeah.
Yeah, outside expectations, it's a lot of times it's fan, it's the public, but also ownership. I think there's a lot of outside expectations who are not observing off the day to day, and they don't have the feel for the situation, the full feel. They see the picture, they see glimpses of it, and then they judge off the glimpses. And you have to be, I can imagine you have to be strong in your opinion and strong in your beliefs, what you see and what you believe in.
For sure. Yeah. And I think that's a huge competitive advantage, is having understanding ownership, which we 100% do here, and looking at the long term and not being kind of reactionary to the ups and downs of sport, which happen every week once the season starts. You know, there's everyone wants to win every game, but there's two teams and one team's going to lose. Totally. Obviously. Having that ability, to be able to be strong enough in your conviction of what you're doing and be able to portray that and manage expectations up and down when things aren't going well is really important.
So you went from the NBA, you decided to go to Perth as a GM. What was the decision making process for you? I mean, you were born and raised in Perth, first of all, so everybody needs to know that, because it's probably an honor and a relief or a pleasure to go back home and be working for your hometown team. I think that's a huge part of the decision, I can imagine. But what was the progression and the decision making process of you picking, or them finding you and deciding on you to take the job to offer it to you, and then you moving to Perth for a longer period and have this plan to leave the NBA? Not many scouts leave the NBA for something else that's let's say less stable.
Yeah, no, it was unique. I was in Philadelphia for 7 seasons. We'd gone through 1.5 COVID years, really. And for some reason, there was always the thought of myself and my wife Megan that, you know, if something came up in Australia and it was the right situation, and Perth was really one of the only situations I think that we would really consider. One, I grew up here, it's home, and I grew up a huge Wildcats fan as a young kid. And it is a big club, and there's a lot of success and history here. So it's an honor and privilege to be able to come into an organization like this and help guide it into the next stage. But yeah, over the 2 years prior to getting hired, I'd had some discussions with the organization about potential positions that could come back to, and then they got bought by a new ownership group, Sports Entertainment Network, who I work for now. And when they decided to bring in a GM of basketball role, I was reached out to, and I jumped at it.
They found you.
Yeah.
Context.
Yeah. Yeah. And we'd had discussions over the previous year and a half about it. at varying levels, but when it became a bit more apparent that like this could be reality, you know, I talked about it obviously with the family, but it was just the right timing. I'd done 7 years in Philadelphia. I'd been through five GMs, and as much as I love the NBA and still do, like it's an amazing place to work and to have a career in. This was just the next step. Like, as you know, when you're in a front office, there's a lot of layers to it, and there's a lot of, you know, you're making a lot of recommendations and you're doing a lot of projections. But you know, at the end of the day, you have presidents and GMs and assistant GMs that make those big decisions and report up to an ownership group. Where in my role in Philly as a director of scouting, it was exciting, but this role as a GM of Perth and being able to hire a whole new coaching staff and kind of start something new as a new project back home in Australia, like it just, the timing was just perfect, and I had to jump at it.
Yeah, it sounds like a dream come true, honestly. You know, despite it, you know, being a dream come true outside of the NBA, but it's still a dream because mm-hmm. you're working for your hometown at a high level.
Yeah, for sure. It really was. It was just amazing that I'd left in 2003 and then came back in 2021. So 18 years, my whole adulthood, I'd been outside of Perth, obviously. Still from there, and to come back and into a role like this has been really, really cool. And yeah, so it's kind of 2 years in, just over 2 years into it, and going to season three though now.
Yeah, that's nice. So describe to me if you had to have a job description in terms of, you know, running a team, how would you describe it in a nutshell?
Yeah, I think it's funny. So like, I was thinking about this the other day, like general manager, like it's very general in scope. Like there's a lot of layers to it, which probably have even had my eyes open to the role. Like, so it's general in every sense, but obviously specific towards basketball related outcomes. And then general manager, like managing a lot of people and a lot more people than I had in Philadelphia when I was a director of scouting, and just the day-to-day management of people, both up and down. So managing up to I guess you would call it a board, an executive board, ownership group, and then managing people underneath you. And, you know, they all have their own lives, their own expectations, their own careers as coaches, as a medical team. We have community and athlete development staff that run a big program and a big part of the organization here. And then being involved in some of the business side, like that's something that's evolved over the last probably year and a bit while I've been in this role, which is completely different, where in the NBA, you're very departmentalized, like basketball is basketball and you have a big staff, and then business is business, where like, I'm sure as you know, in Europe, it's similar, like the staffs are smaller because the organizations aren't as big. And you kind of have your hands in everything. And so it's been, yeah, challenging at times, but also exciting that you're learning new parts. And then also like dealing with league, like in the NBA as a scout, you don't really deal with anything with the league, but here we're in constant contact with the NBL, their expectations. There's so many things that go with it. And as this league grows, it's exciting, but there's also big responsibility because you're running a pretty big franchise that has a big following, and during the season there's just a lot going on.
Yeah, but so tell me what intrigues you the most about this job, from all the layers you just mentioned, you know, there has to be something that really, because I can imagine it being overwhelming at some point. You know, you have impulses from every direction, and at some point you just probably want to throw the phone through the window because it just gets, you know, yeah, it's on fire. But what's the thing that really draws you into the profession and you find enjoyment in?
Yeah, honestly, is like getting is winning an NBL championship. I want that more than nothing for this team, for the city of Perth. Like, they've had a lot of success. They've won 10 titles in their 43 years now. So like for us, like it's getting back to that level. It's rebuilding and it's continuing to evolve the franchise. Like, I think over the last couple of years, especially this past off season one, we've kind of rebuilt the roster to where John Riley, our head coach, and I kind of see it and see the future, but also like bringing the club global. Like, we managed to get the team over to Las Vegas this year, which is amazing. So we played the G League Ignite, and the timing of it, I think, actually worked out really well for the club in general. I think we had a lot of media attention globally as we played the Ignite. And then obviously, as we go through the next couple of seasons, it's just really evolving the club. You know, there's many facets to it, but, you know, the next stage is hopefully, you know, you're getting your own practice facility and continuing to improve our Wildcats Academy, which we started this year, and try to develop, you know, young talent through that and develop coaching and just improve the standard of basketball in Perth and Australia in general.
There's a lot of, you know, it's future projections. So you're working basically always, you're always thinking about the future, about the next steps. You always kind of have to anticipate certain things that are happening, and you're always building. Is there any kind of advice you're following from somebody, or some mentorship you receive from other people in the business that you value? Or who would be, I would not necessarily hearing the names, but what roles, or who would you reach out to, or do you reach out to someone, or are you trying to do everything yourself? Do you think it's important to ask for help sometimes?
Oh yeah. I'm definitely the first one to put my hand up. I'm always trying to ask for help. There's a lot of situations that I find myself in that are probably unfamiliar for me, or the first time. And so whether it's other sport directors or GMs in Europe that I know from my time there, or I had worked with and are now working in Europe, talking to people from other sporting codes, so like AFL clubs. Okay. So I think those clubs in Australia are easily one of the most professional, easily the most professional in Australia, but globally, I think the way they run their organizations is really, really high level. And so finding ways that, like, some of the concepts and some of the ideas that I have that have come maybe from my experience in the NBA or from Europe don't necessarily fit Australian sport, maybe. Mm-hmm. But trying to lean on those contacts as to, like, what works in this environment, in this culture, and relearning that. But then also, you know, understanding how the G League and the NBA work, and kind of ways that we can incorporate some of the concepts that they use day to day and the processes they use. So, yeah, it's basketball, as you know more than anyone, like, it's such a global profession. You're always in contact with people around the world. And so trying to find best practices, wherever they're from, and that can help our organization, I think is something that I definitely lean on.
So what would be one thing, if you can cross compare across other sports within the Australian culture, let's say the AFL, you reach out to certain clubs, what's the one thing that pops into your head right now that you felt like you could apply the easiest, and you in the past you did apply the easiest? What's one thing that pops out right away?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely many. One thing would probably be implementing, anything from, say, uniform guidelines, like stuff like, how does our team want to portray itself in the public? Mm-hmm. Do we want to be all seen as a cohesive unit? And every time we're in the public eye or the public sphere, we're representing the Perth Wildcats. And also the partners that sponsor our club. We have some really big partnerships with big companies and organizations. So, like, what are some of the parameters we put in place for our staff and for our players that make us come across as this professional organization that's unified? And so part of that is, what do players and staff wear into games? What are we wearing on the court? How are we traveling as a team? Obviously, you know, you're in the public eye, and we have a really big following. We're really relevant in the Perth and the Western Australian sporting landscape. So, like, our season starts when the AFL stops. And so from now until the end of our season, we're in the public eye. So anything good or bad that happens with the Perth Wildcats is magnified in our media landscape here. So making sure that whenever we're out there, we're representing the club, we're giving access to people that want access to the club, so we can continue to improve our brand. And so understanding from other sporting clubs in Australia, like, how they do that, and if they're successful at it, can we implement that into our organization?
So the public perception is a priority in most of the Australian clubs, you would say? Of how you portray your team to the outside?
Yeah, maybe I use perception, but, like, the reality of it, like, is that a real thing? Like, we want the public to understand, like, what we stand for. Yeah. And I think as we evolve the club, that's something we want people to understand, is, like, this is what we stand for. We're obviously inclusive. We We are a community-based club that we want to develop basketball at the grassroots level all the way up to being a professional basketball team that wins championships and all that encompasses. So it's a big responsibility, but I think as we continue to grow and take things from other organizations that could be successful here, that's definitely things we're always looking to do.
That's something I feel it's important for sure. And I think that starts, and that's something it's been really pondering about because of the podcast, other podcasts I listen to. I'm just podcast. I don't want to say pothead because it sounds weird, but a podcast head. You know, the outside perception or outside persona or outside that how you're portrayed is important. Then to make it look real, it has to be internally real, you know. And I just listened to a podcast where they talked about Sir Alex Ferguson from Manchester United, of how you build a culture within, you know. And within, I don't know, was it 30 years? I don't know how long he was coaching there, for a long time. And in all those years, he had to step into the locker room because of a conflict only twice. So the culture, essentially, culture runs culture. So if you're building culture, you have to have the right people in place to represent the culture internally. That way, it gets the culture manages itself. You know, I've seen it in the locker room in Lithuania as well. But I can imagine Manchester United during those glory times, they were policing each other, and Sir Alex Ferguson did not have to step in at all, except two times in all those years that he was coaching. So I think once that is taken care of as a basis, I think automatically that will trickle down to the outside, and those things will shine bright in the outside.
For sure. Yeah. And, you know, we want this to be a player-driven program. Yeah. And we want to give them all the resources they can to perform at the optimal level. And so for us, yeah, exactly. I think once you start putting in place, you know, parameters and processes where players are policing that themselves, then that's the ultimate, right? Then you don't have to intervene. You don't have to put in systems that are holding people accountable because they're already held to account by themselves. Because they're so ingrained into the system and the organization and what it stands for.
I think the All Blacks are probably also a good example of that in terms of how they build their culture, because they were really at the bottom at one point, and then they just rebuild the whole rugby culture in New Zealand, and just became, you know, they were policing each other, they were taking care of each other, it was taking care of itself basically.
Yeah, definitely.
So what challenges do you find on a day-to-day basis the most that you run into? We're going to go through a process a little bit, through your process, not the process, but through your personal process in the club and in your job. But what challenges do you run into most commonly?
Yeah, I think most commonly, I think there's probably, because there's two ways to look at it. There's obviously in season or in season now, and then there's the off season. It never stops. Obviously, even now we're trying to prepare. Well, I'm starting to prepare for next off season. And so I think day to day, it's making sure that I'm checking in with our coaching staff and John, especially, that we're aligned. So how best I can support him as he goes through each day, trying to prepare the team to be the most successful in that. In the next game, and taking it game by game. So making sure that I'm ticking that box, and making sure then that everything else that is running underneath, whether it's continuing to look at our recruiting for an emergency list. So like obviously our roster's set, but we always got to be prepared for an injury, team underperforming, any opportunity that might present itself on the market that could be, you know, be an addition, and then preparing ourselves for the off season. So making sure those things are running constantly, while also making sure that like the playing group, obviously there's the medical staff that we check in with on player availability and where guys are at if they're injured, and then there's the ownership piece, reporting up to them, and then making sure that all these other game day events, things that are happening, are being attended to as well. So like when these game days happen, all these different events are about to occur, that everyone's communicated to, and everyone's in lockstep in the whole organization. So when these unexpected things happen, we can kind of control them internally.
So you mentioned the communication with the coach. It's on a daily basis, but talk to me a little bit about the cultural aspect of that, because I know from the sense I get in Australia, it's not a direct culture. It's more subtle. It's more between the lines. You portray a message to the coach or to whoever, not necessarily the coach, but whoever, and then you let them know through subtle expressions or your opinion, without him or the position being offended by your opinion. Is that correct? Is that something that you feel like that needs to be, you know, there's a cultural communication aspect, I think, and there needs to be a clear line, and not everybody has the cognizant awareness to absorb all the information you're trying to tell them. I think in Japan is similar. It's a indirect line of communication. While you're communicating, you're actually saying much more than you're verbally saying.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it starts with the trust and relationship, like with the coach and the GM. And like John and I 100% have that. Like he's awesome. And I think that partnership goes a long way to where hopefully we'll bring the organization long term. And so having a coach that's really open, receptive to new ideas, and then we talk constantly about players, whether they're our own guys or guys that we're looking at potentially to bring in. I think those conversations have to be open and honest, and like all viewpoints are taken in. And then at the end of the day, a decision has to be made. So there's got to be pretty firm, like, no, this is what I believe. This is the right thing to do. Are we in lockstep? Are we in agreement or not, kind of thing? And vice versa, like when other things come up, whether it's staff changes, staff additions, like as we evaluate the program at the end of the year and go into exit interviews, like what were our objectives for the season? Were we successful in them? Yes. Well, yes or no. And if no, definitely why not? And how can we improve on that? And so making sure that we're constantly on the same page, and I'm more than anything, I'm supporting him, because at the end of the day, he's the one coaching the players on the team, and he's got to have the right guys that he thinks will fit his system. And so that's been a challenge. Obviously, John's the second coach I've had. We've had here in Perth in going to year three, but this is the second season with JR. And so this off season was really beneficial so we could evaluate together one season and build towards another in kind of unison.
Yeah, I think it's very important at this tier of communication to not take things personally. I think it has to be, there has to be certain, like you said, openness and trust that there's the intent is a good intent, you know, it's for the common good. There's no subtlety, or there's nothing, no subtle attacks to each other. It's a real open communication for the sake of winning a championship. So apart from that, what do you look for in the coach and the head coach when you're observing, you know, your throughout your vision, what do you think a coach has to bring into the franchise that you feel like is integral for the success?
Yeah, great question. I think the first one is obviously they want to partner with you. Like I don't think you can go into any of this and having to make decisions that you're in unison with, and you have to portray those up to an ownership board that you're in lockstep and this is what you want to do, when you're not really on the same page. So like making sure that person wants to work in partnership with you. And then I would say, yeah, in terms of actual coaching acumen, like, I mean, this was John's first head coaching experience, but all of the experience he had before this, you could just tell was leading up to him being a really, really, I think, high profile. Well, he's going to be a highly successful head coach. He's very good with player relationships. He was a player himself, high level player. So he understands.
One of the best shooters in Australian history.
He is. Yeah, he still is. He still is. Oh man, he'll still get out on the court and torch our guys in drills. And he's a gym rat still. So having someone that has those player relationships already built, and he breathes the game, but he also understands what players are going through the ups and downs of a season, and can relate to them really well. But then also he's really open to his assistants giving him ideas. I think that's really important. So he's not just stuck in like, all right, this is how we're doing it, and we're not making adjustments. Just because, like, he's very open to that. And he's been fantastic in growing the staff as well, and giving them a lot of freedom to take ownership of different parts of the program, and supporting them through it, and giving them really honest feedback. And so I think that's a big important part as well, as much as you want your players to have success. And for us, it's like for our guys to go on to the NBA, whether it's some of our young guys get drafted, or, you know, some of our guys that go on to a EuroLeague situation, fantastic. Like, they're using the Perth Wildcats to go to a different situation. It's the same as our staff. We want some of our coaches, some of our medical team, if they get a chance to then go to the NBA or go to another program that can elevate their career or give them a different experience, like, we're all about that. So making sure that we're growing people and treating them as people, not just employees or, you know, just coaches. Like, these, everyone has their own story. Everyone's got their own personal life, and making sure there's a big balance to that as well, because it's important. Because as you know, during a season, it gets draining. And you got to give people the time to recharge, be around family, get away from, the office for a little bit, or the job, so they can recharge and bring back a re-energized mindset, so that can help the team continue to grow.
Yeah, absolutely. Shout out to Brady Manning for at this point, because he's probably went to a EuroLeague situation now. So it's going to be interesting to see how that's also, you know, coming to Perth and then to Turkey. And now there's a pathway there, definitely. To get back on the things you said about the head coach empowering assistant coaches, empowering people in an organization, I think that it roots in secure coaching, you know, that there's no sense of insecurity when you're accepting other people's opinion, you're listening, you're able to absorb, and you give them ownership in their ideas, and you give your assistants kind of a role that they feel that they're contributing, actually. And that's why it immediately rang a bell, because our head coach of the national team is like that, and he's really, that's why the respect level for him is so high from the players and the staff, because he listens to everyone, and he also has his own opinion. Obviously, he has to make, like you said, the decision has to be made by someone at some point, depending on the tiers, whether it's management or the coaching part. But listening and being able to absorb opinions and accept them that are not yours, and you have to admit that they're better, it takes balls, and it takes really a personality and security to really be able to buy into that and stand behind it. I think that's a great sign for a coach.
Definitely. No, totally agree. And definitely over the last, this is John's second season, but he 100% empowers all of our staff to kind of contribute in every way possible that they can, and gives them the freedom to obviously express their opinions, and then he takes them in and then makes his own decision. But the fact that he gives them that open channel of communication is, I think, a really good trait.
It's huge, and it's supposed to be part of the culture, because everybody feels involved, everybody feels like they're contributing, and that's a huge but subtle part that not everybody gets it. Not everybody gets.
Yep.
Before we go into the family part that you mentioned, that's important to have the balance. And I'm curious to hear your process of it. But we're wanted to touch on two things. First, what do you, if I may dig a little bit in your process, what are the things you look for in practice when you observe practices, and you watch players, you watch the communication between the players and the coaches, you watch the captainship? What are the things that draws your attention the most, and you kind of hinge an opinion on?
Yeah, great question. So watching practice, I mean, and there's some days that you don't even get a chance to go down there because you're stuck with so many other, you're putting out fires or you're dealing with other things, which is unfortunate, but it's the reality of this role. But yeah, I definitely try and get down there at least once every day to check in, whether it's the last 30 minutes or maybe it's a whole practice. But I think part of it is in relation to where the team's at. So if we've come off a loss, and you know everyone's on edge because we're going into another big weekend, and you really want to get results that are favorable. Like seeing players' reactions to it, which guys are coming in, putting in extra work, which guys are positive, are guys still dragging their heads? That can be kind of telling. And then you know questions around like, you know, then I, you know, John and I will get together and get a pulse of where the team's at. But I think for us, it's like making sure and looking at how competitive practices are. And like, I think if you have good energy and competitive practices for the better part of a week or for the better part of a month or for the season, I think you're going to be pretty successful long term. Now, if guys come in and aren't as competitive or just going through the motions, then there's probably something off. And you probably have to look at either its personnel or like coaching wise, like what are we doing to try and get these guys to a level that's going to have them practicing at a championship type level that you need to be winning games in the NBL. So I think there's definitely a few things. And then for us, like we have an experienced group up top, and then we have some really young prospects, and it's exciting getting to see those guys and how they compete day to day. On the practice court and see which guys are really putting in the extra effort to make sure that one, they're improving their game, but also giving them the best chance to earn minutes for that next game or whatever. So I think there's a few things to look at, and obviously just the general feel of the group, but in terms of like the overall competitiveness of practice and how guys are actually trying to compete every day, I think is really telling on probably how that next week's games are going to go.
I agree. It's part of, like you said, reaction and body language and just the grid that you observe in the players, the competitive spirit. I think that all those things are very subtle, and it's important that the coach has also player experience as a player, and you have experience as a player, and that those things are important to absorb and take into, and then take into account into the whole process. But it's yeah. This word process keeps repeating itself here today. So exactly. To touch on one thing that your process is like on in terms of note taking on a day to day basis, or if you're like you said, you're preparing, you're watching players to be prepared in an emergency situation. What tools do you use? What are the things that you that note taking on a computer, on a phone, on a notepad, yellow pad, or whatever you use that's something that maybe people wouldn't think of, or FastScout database? Is that what's something that you really rely on the most in the day to day?
Yeah, I would say. I don't write a lot, like handwritten notes is something that's, my handwriting is horrendous now because a lot of it's just like with your thumbs, right? So you're typing. So I use obviously notes on my iPhone, and I store a lot of stuff on that. But FastScout, we definitely use. I think that's a really good tool. Obviously you're watching Synergy, you're downloading games from whether it's Huddle or Hoop One or whatever, watching clips on Synergy. But constantly, storing information when I'm talking to people about certain players. So making sure that, like, if I get intel, it's written, but then it's, put into, like, readable format, and then saving it and then sharing that with relevant parties within the organization. If we're about to sign a player and I've just got four or five reports from different sources around the world where he's played, making sure that's put into whether it's a PDF form and then stored in like files on my computer. So ones you can pull up. Now, we don't have the same amount of resources as like, I'm sure what you're using at Boston or what we had in Philadelphia or the NBA, where these are like live databases that are continuously updated and they have analytical numbers and projections through them. We don't unfortunately have that. Would love to get there one day, but definitely driven in terms of like, yeah, being organized to an extent of like, yeah, if you've got lists of players that you're constantly digging on guys, so when opportunities do come, you've got information at your disposal to make decisions quickly.
It's so hard because there's so much information that you just get randomly without really accounting for, because you feel like I'll remember that, you know, you have random conversations here and there, you get bits and pieces, and then that's the job that for us is probably most underrated, because you have to actually, man, I have to put it, not a mental note, but I have to really put a note in, and you just put it in the phone and you collect those notes, and at some point it's part of the puzzle as well. But because sometimes it's just one sentence or one little fact that you didn't hear, you wouldn't hear randomly about in a conversation that was not supposed to be about that, you know, and then it mentions about a different player, some different facts, and pulling that detail here into the same note. And it's an underrated aspect of our job, I think, that you note collecting.
For sure. Even like voice memos can be good. Like if you've had a conversation and then maybe you've finished the meeting and you're walking home or something from a coffee shop, then like, yeah, you can just speak into a voice memo and record, kind of regurgitate what information you heard. And then when you get home, then you have that at your disposal to either type back up or send to someone
Yeah, I did that before too. When you do those Intel calls, and you just, because you have several Intel calls in a row, and sometimes you're doing that on a walk, you know, you're not doing it just, so you're trying to have absorb everything that you get in, and then once you get off the call, you're, like you said, you're repeating everything to yourself in a voice memo and kind of summarizing everything you just talked about. And it's good. I think note taking by handwritten notes is probably a better way of memorizing it, just because you're putting hand to paper, pen to paper, and that's maybe as a memory, it's easier to bring back again. But voice memos and talking and maybe summarizing it, having cliff notes in your head about it, I think is also a good tool to bring it back whenever you need it.
Yeah, for sure.
So before we go into the ATOs and the quick hitters, and I'm going to bombard you with some quick questions. What's your process? Here we go again. Process. Here we go. What's the balance that you use to spend time with your family away from the job? And what are the time and periods that you dedicated your personal time to the family? And are you completely off the phone? Are you completely, because Will Weaver, which you know also as good as I do, he really puts the phone away, and he just dedicates his time to the family for that amount of hours or whatever, and spends a good amount together without being distracted. What's your process in this whole personal life?
Yeah, it's really difficult. As you said, it's really hard to put away the phone, because you just never know what's going to come up. It is 24/7. But over the last probably year, and Megan, if she does listen to this, she'll probably think I'm lying, but I do really try from 6 to 8. So try to be home by 6, and from 6 to 8, I'm present with the family. We're eating dinner. Kids are getting put to bed. And that's really the time where it's like, all right, don't answer the phone. Or if you have a message or whatever, you don't really need to get back to it until after 8. And then if it's really important, then you get back to it. Or it can wait a little bit longer, whether it's an email or a text or whatever. So that's kind of on a normal day. Obviously in the mornings, trying to help as much as I can with the kids, whether I have to drop them at school on the way to work or those sort of things. But definitely trying to be more present with the family. And in this role, because we have a 28-game season, longer off season, it is more favorable to a family conducive lifestyle. And I think living in Australia probably helps that as well. Like, it is a really good place to raise a family. And so that's been a good part of moving down here, where the US is very, very 24/7, and the scouting cycle just doesn't end. I know you're in it now. It's probably 11 months of the year. There's always events going on.
Yeah.
And there's always events being added. So, but definitely missing that as well. So, you know, you miss some of that as well. Cause that was always the travel and going around to different, going around to different events and seeing a lot of different people. So, but yeah, just trying to be more present with the family without the phone in the hand, and making sure that like some things just aren't a priority. Like I always try and get back to people quickly. Obviously there's more important people we have to get back to, AKA your bosses, if they hit you, or like if I'm talking to John and some stuff. But, there are some times where it's like, all right, this is not as important as what I need to do with the kids or with the family. So, definitely not perfect in that sense, far from it. And I'm trying to improve, but I do think this role has helped me maybe balance my life a little bit better than I had before.
I'm still learning of how to process that and dedicate time to my personal life and not feel like I'm being pushed to it, you know, but kind of I want to be pulled by the social life, because it's important. And I think the biggest study on happiness was done in the US over a course of 70 years, I think, or something like that. And the most common denominator between all the happiest people was that their social circle and their personal life in terms of relationships with people was in line and was deeply rooted in love, dedication, time together, socializing, and not in material things, not in money, not in anything else, not in the success. It's just one branch that is leads to happiness, but the core of it was the relationships and the people around you that made you happy. So that's one thing that I'm still kind of, you know, we're so absorbed with career and with life in terms of sports life and achieving and being gritty with it, you know, and trying to find the perfect team construct the perfect team, etc. And we forget about the other parts that kind of gives you energy, maybe, you know, to make the right decisions. And maybe that's the balance that we're missing, honestly, for the success is the personal life.
Yeah, couldn't agree with you more there. It's we're all self-absorbed in our careers and trying to find that next thing, or yeah, like you said, trying to find the perfect roster. And there's always something you can be doing. You're always going to be playing catch up in this business. And so, yeah, being content with, maybe not content's the right word, but being comfortable with where you're at and understanding that like the natural process, the natural course of life is just gonna happen. and having that balance, you know, having your relationship with your family, having your relationship with, you know, whether you're religious, like finding that time to take care of yourself health-wise, like, you know, that's a huge one. You know, I definitely try and do that every morning. I think that's the best, for me, the best way is to get up early. If I get up really early, I do work and then I go for a run or I work out, and then your day started and you've already ticked off some boxes. So by 7 o'clock when the kids are getting ready for school, or 8 o'clock when you're driving to work, like you've already ticked off some stuff and you feel like you've achieved some things through the day that, like, usually if you don't do that in the morning, especially me, if I don't get a workout in the morning, by 4 o'clock, it's not happening. Like things are just piled up and you're just not doing it. So it's got to happen then. And that, I think that's just, as life goes on, I think you just, yeah, you try and fit things in. And I do think early morning rituals are pretty key, I think, for people that are in probably busy, high stress type pressurized environments. I think having a really structured early morning can really help get your day off to the right start and put you in the right mindset.
I agree. I have that too. I go for a speed. I can't run, but I go for a speed walk every morning and also put a podcast in my ear, or just kind of go with my race, with my thoughts, come back, have a workout, and then start the day off right, and have already some sweat that I put out. And that, you know, you exert energy, but that kind of gives you energy. That's something that's counterintuitive for a lot of people, but that is the truth. It boils down to that. And plus our bodies are used to it from the past, and they need it, you know, they need to exert this energy.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely agreed.
You're ready for my ATOs?
I'm curious about them. Yeah.
All right.
Hit me.
All right. So, do's and don'ts in your job right now. One do and one don't.
Great question. Do is be very open and communicative with everything. So open lines of communication, whether it's up to ownership or down through your staff, making sure you have an open door policy, and just being completely open with and transparent as much as you can. Obviously, there's some things that have to stay at certain levels, but I think communication is crucial. And so making sure that people feel like they can always come to you with things, and then you also communicate what needs to be communicated so people are informed of whatever's happening. Probably don't be so self-absorbed that you don't listen. So I think listening. So like, just don't be so self-absorbed that you think that what you're doing is the only way that it can be done. You've always got to be completely open to learning, completely open to feedback, and completely open to understanding that you're going to make mistakes and not everything's going to go the right way. And just continuously learn, own up to mistakes, and just don't be that person that just is so stuck in their ways that like when change has to happen, that you're so rigid that it just can't for you. So like, yeah, I think that don't be so self-absorbed in your own thinking that this is the only way to do things.
Yep. Best non-basketball Twitter follow, or X, I guess it's called X now, X follow, Twitter follow. Let's keep it Twitter. The best non-basketball Twitter follow.
Jeez, that's a good one. It's funny you say this, and this may not be the answer you're looking for, but like, I've gotten so far off Twitter. Like, I think we've talked about it. Like, I have an account. I never tweet. I follow a lot of it's basketball news, but like, honestly, I'll get off it. I'll delete the account off my phone, so I'm not on it. And so I'm not tempted to read anything. And then maybe certain day in a week, I'll put it on and like notifications will come on and you read stuff.
Interesting.
And then I'll completely delete it, just because like I found, it can be toxic. 100% can be really toxic. And so, yeah, honestly, like, yeah, haven't like the Twitter sphere for me. And obviously, like you said, it's X now. Couldn't off the top of my head now, because I'm so far removed from the day to day of it. I don't really have, but I do. I definitely follow motivational type accounts that give you some sort of like a good way to maybe start your day, whether it's motivational speakers or people within sports industry that might have some good follows. Those things will pop up, but really, yeah, I'm pretty far off Twitter at the moment.
That's surprising, but at the same time, it's also healthier, probably. So you're probably, you can get the information you need probably in other ways. It's just sometimes it can be scattered all over the place. So not necessarily the best place, but it can be good and it can be terrible. Just depends.
I used to be on it a lot, especially when you're working in the NBA. I think it's crucial for information. But yeah, when it can get toxic, then yeah, you can get sucked into it. Yeah.
Something personal about you that I couldn't find on Google, or that I wouldn't be able to find on Google.
Jeez, I'm not sure you can find much. I don't think there'll be much on Google on me. I've got 3 passports, so I'm not sure if that's on there, but yeah, right. So there you go. So obviously Australian, Irish, and American. So yeah, I got the US. I'm a US citizen as well.
You're like a diplomat.
American. Yeah. So I carry the 3, and actually all our 3 kids have them. So they're very like, and Nicholas was born in Germany.
Yeah.
He was born in Germany and has Australian, American, Irish. So, unique kind of storyline there. That's probably the one thing, I think. Yeah.
Any books, quotes, or particular slogans you like to look at or remember or to read, if it's a book, something that you kind of like to fall back on if you're struggling, if you're thinking about something?
You know what? I wish I wish I read more. It's funny. I buy these books that I'm really interested in. Like I'll see them. I'll see someone promote it and I want to read it. And then I'll get it and it's on my desk and like life happens and you just never get a chance. Like you might read the first chapter and I'm really interested and then I just never finish it. So that's kind of like, you know, there's books like Outliers, Malcolm Gladwell.
Yep.
I think he's got some really cool stuff. Grit. I think that was Angela Duckworth. Yep. Is another one that's really cool. Like those sort of books I'm interested in. I think they're relevant to our industry. I think they're relevant to, as you know, I guess as sports executives, like you're trying to find ways that you can, I guess, gather more insight into how you evaluate people and what makes people tick and what makes people successful to an extent. And so those are kind of the books if I am reading, like I get into those. But other than that, yeah, I definitely listen to podcasts. A lot of it's basketball driven, just like information gathering. Always open for suggestions. I should probably do that more often actually, is ask, because like there's definitely times driving to work or going for a run. I wish I had a better podcast to listen to.
I'll send you some. Or I have some in my rotation every day.
No, for sure. I'm definitely going to hit you on that. Yeah.
Best personal purchase you made in the last 12 months?
Ooh, great question. Personal purchase, I would say, and this was more for the family as well, but I guess personal purchase was air tickets to Bali. So you've been there, right?
Yeah.
So we take, obviously, from Perth, like Bali's only a 4-hour flight, even less. Yeah, so that was really cool. We took the family there for the Easter school holidays and spent like 10 days, and that was awesome. Like,
that's cool.
And just, yeah, it's such a cool place for kids. And then, yeah, really cool to see that type of culture. Had been there once before, but not for years. And I think, you know, because we're so close to Southeast Asia, I think we'll end up exploring more of that part of the world.
Yeah, Philippines is underrated, man. I would definitely go there with the family. There's nice. Highlights also for kids with the scuba diving, or I mean, it was a hidden gem for me. Nice discovery.
Love it. I like it. Yep.
Biggest pet peeve for you as an executive in regards to the team?
Really good question. Probably again, like, and this is probably why I'm not as much on social, but like, is probably the outside noise, yeah, perception. And just, it's hard to say, like, opinions that aren't based on anything, in fact, just like, and reactionary to like a certain small event, a one-off game, like just being very short-sighted on the whole big picture. But I totally understand it. I get it. And that's sport, and that's why fans are fans. But yeah, definitely that can be quite I guess frustrating if you let it infiltrate your thinking, which is why you shouldn't.
Yeah.
Because you're never gonna make everyone happy.
Yeah.
So like there's always people that won't be happy and won't like you, and that's part of life and that's fine. And so just managing what you can control what you can control. It's easy to say that. It's really hard to live that. And yeah. So I've definitely felt that the last 2 years. It's just like things aren't always going to go the way you want them to. As much as you can put into it, they just won't. I think there's a plan. I think, you know, there's a plan for everything, and it doesn't always work out that way. And you just got to be positive. And if you put the work in, you believe in what you're doing, you're strongly convicted, you work with, and you are a good person, then usually results will unfold the way they should. And usually that's in a positive fashion. And if they don't, well, then you got to learn. And then you learn from your mistakes and you come back stronger the next time.
Perfect. Let's leave it at that. I think I drilled you. I drilled a lot of holes in there.
Awesome, man.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for being here, man. I appreciate it. I think there's a lot of value in this conversation, a lot of gems that I think people can take away, especially aspiring GMs, scouts, executives. So your experience is very valuable, and I appreciate you sharing so candidly and openly about everything.
No, Benis, thank you, man. Your friendship over the years has been amazing. Yeah, I'm really curious to see where your path goes. I know it's gonna continue to rise in the profession. I'm really excited for where you're headed, but also like when our paths cross, we're kind of, you know, depends on where we're working in the future, but I think we'll always have a really strong friendship, and I really appreciate all your support over the years.
Yeah, man, we'll definitely do it. It all started in Berlin, and now we're going to continue on throughout this. The world has gotten smaller, I think, over the years. It's just easy to reach for both of us. So I'm glad we're our friendship holds up, and we'll continue to do that.
For sure. I love it.
All right, take care, and good luck with everything. Good luck this weekend.
Thanks, Benis. Appreciate it.
All right. Bye.
Bye.